again. Our doctrine is clear. We will confront emerging threats before they fully materialize. And if you harbor a terrorist, you're just as guilty as the terrorist. On the offense. We'll complete our work in Afghanistan and Iraq. An immediate withdrawal of our troops in Iraq or the broader Middle East, as some have called for, would only embolden the terrorists and create a staging ground to launch more attacks against America and free nations. So long as I'm the president, we will stay. We will fight, and we will win.
Is the threat to humanity. And then you talk about anyone who harbors terrorists is just as guilty as the terrorists. Okay, so since you're harboring Toto Constance, Emmanuel Constance, the legendary terrorist out of Haiti, well, you're right. You are just as guilty. After all, you're the Frankenstein that created the monster. So, instead of you staying on the offensive, as you claim, it's time for you to get on the defensive, head coffin style. It's time for the slaves to come into revolt. Because an immediate withdrawal of the capitalists from the face of the earth is the only type of withdrawal we'll tolerate. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, 107.5 North Carolina, LUBER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe. Click into the slave web. Just go Google web, Slave Revolt Radio, find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into the politics of peace and what that means in American politics and in the American context today. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong. You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. Amount of energy that's going to flow out.
tonight, what we're going to deal with is, you know, how often in America, the peace movement has an overinflated idea of itself. What its accomplishments have been and stand for. And questions like what it really means to be a peace, quote unquote, activist. In the American bourgeois interpretation in international political arena as it stands. These things often go somewhat unchallenged, but not tonight as a slave is about to explore the politics of peace. First, we're going to start off with Felice Zapata. She had a son, American G.I. Joe's son, who was killed over there in Iraq. She's hooked up now with Cindy Sheehan and the Gold Star Family for Peace. And Zapata talks about Boy George's statement about the Iraqi conflict and staying the course. It was the same little statement that I blew up at the beginning of the show. So let's see what Zapata has to say. And then let's take some of this beyond the shadow. Check it out.
I just found it appalling and kind of opportunistic on the president's part. And I also thought about all the families who are sitting in Crawford who have already lost someone and who are ignored. I also thought of the family from Georgia, the Waste family, who has 5 family members who have served a total of 58 months of service in Iraq, and they're opposed to the war. I mean, it's almost, you know, I don't want to be part of dueling families. And I respect the service of all of the people who would give their lives towards the country. I mean, that's a whole different thing than the policy of this administration. And, you know, I listened to that speech and it seemed so jingoistic and actually empty, because there wasn't actually much in terms of a plan. It was kind of a lot of flag waving, well scripted. You know, I think the president's script writers did a real nice job. But in terms of giving our country a direction, of telling us any new information about when our soldiers are coming home, or about plans for peace, or answering any of the questions that all of us have been raising about the war, you know, it was shallow. And I, you know, respond to it very much as representing all the families who were waiting for their turn to speak, and feel that, you know, the president so carefully talks to people who agree with him. You have to have a ticket that says you agree in order to get near the president.
Okay, you know, Zapata starts off with this statement, which is kind of like, almost like an official statement by many of these people in this fraction, where they're talking about how they support the troops, but more or less their philosophy is to bring them home. And they say that, I respect the service of all people who die for this country. See, this is classic Democrat, petty bourgeois, and bourgeois ideology. This type of analysis concept is acceptable to the rulers, and it's acceptable within the arena of a debate between the rulers, since there is certain splits within the ruling class right now about should they stay or pull out. I mean, that's the major opening. The opening hasn't come from some kind of moral consciousness amongst the masses, amongst the so-called leaders, amongst the rulers within this society in America. That has nothing to do with it. It has to do with the fact that many people in elite circles see the quagmire. The military sees dissension growing amongst its ranks. Its recruitment is going down and down. And they see themselves admired in a form of imperial quicksand. So within that context, Cindy Sheehan and company have come around at the right time. They look the right way. Their range of debate concerning a particular issue is acceptable. Now, of course, it's going to be lambasted by the extreme reactionary forces of the ruling circle, because they're just playing a game. They're playing their form of extremism, as we got into last week, which is basically to over-rant and rail on purpose to basically neuter any kind of opposition. It's the same way they keep harping on the liberal media, as they keep expanding within their vision the type of media openings and media slots under their fold. But this, when she talks about, I have respect for the service of all people who died for this country, one has to wonder, does anyone of conscience have respect for the soldiers who fought for the Nazis, the fact that they died for their country, respect for them? See, there's a disconnect that's going on, and it's a nationalistic, jingoistic type of disconnect that the Democrats and their supporters portray in the same way that they denounce, rightfully so, and others do too, how Boy George and company get jingoistic. But if you have respect for the service of all people who die for this country, and they're not dying for any kind of noble cause, they're dying for imperial causes. They are taking their marching orders and going out on imperial crusade missions of genocidal destruction. Now, if you happen to die within that process, there's nothing noble or respectful about it. You're a fool, at the very least, and then you're just a little conscious criminal. You know, at some of the worst ends of it. In other words, you know what Sam is up to, you're down with it, and you just want to get your cowboy boots on and go rape and pillage the world. But either way, being a sucker in this day and age, or just being an imperial hooligan, there's nothing respectful, and there's nothing redeeming out of that. So, but see, once again, within the parameters of how these types of discussions are developed within the quote-unquote peace type movement, this is a type of tone you're expected to take, that you're not against the soldiers, which basically means you're not against what they're doing, even though they're the ones over there firing the bullets and shooting off the depleted uranium. You're just against the policies that have them go do it. So there's no class responsibility amongst those people who are G.I. Joes. And if there's no class responsibility, then you can't have any kind of real humanitarian class alignment or force and steel class alignment with any people throughout the world who are under the boot of the imperialist bombardment. Now, as she talked about, you know, and as they talk about, you know, pulling the troops home and on and on and on, and that this is supposed to represent peace, you know, part of the thing that's a fallacy of this whole concept is that it's pretty well known, and this is double talk, that the politically correct democratic peace movement types do. We all know that a pullout of the troops really doesn't mean a pullout. Because we all know that within this context of what they're talking about, that all those bases, 13, 14 plus bases that they're building and have built in Iraq, are going to remain. So even when they talk about pullout, they're not talking about a complete withdrawal where all the soldiers come out. They're just talking about the forces that are involved in an active engagement, direct engagement. But we're still talking about imperial occupation. But for many of these quote-unquote peace activists, if this type of pullout were to take place, the type of pullout where you didn't have the troops going into areas like Fallujah and other regions, many of them, overwhelmingly, they would find this successful and they would find it acceptable. And they would then call it a success and then pat themselves on the back as being part of a movement that helped in the war. But if Sam still controls the resources, still has occupational forces, and is still doing his covert and not so covert operations within, you know, whatever type of, you know, Islamic governmental reactionary regime, that's no freedom for anyone. And it's still part of an act of war. This is the same type of strategy and mentality that the many of the progressive and Democrat types laid down for when Crime Bill Clinton was president. Remember, Crime Bill Clinton becomes president. And during that particular time, it wasn't considered a war, even though more people died under Clinton's administration that have died under Boy George's administration in Iraq. The sanctions, the attacks on the water supply that Crime Bill was doing, the no-fly zones, these had a devastating effect on the population. And in essence, they were part of the continuous imperial war. An imperial war that basically all that happened was one administrator for the ruling class simply passed off its baton to the next administrator for the ruling class, i.e. Democrats gave the baton to the Republicans, and we've been shuffled into this next episode of imperial destruction. They went hand in hand. So within that context, one can't look at the art of war by imperialists simply when you have your little G.I. Joe troops shooting actively on the ground and getting shot at and killed. See, what one sees when one hears this type of stuff from these types of peace activists is that their main concern is the fact that U.S. G.I. Joes are getting killed at high number. Because when the imperial structure of domination and control and fierceness was having a devastating toll on the Iraqi population during the Crime Bill Clinton administration through all the forms of imperial sanctions, you didn't have this type of outcry from these so-called peace activists. But next, let's go into Salis Zapata talking about her description of her being called a peace or her considering herself a peace extremist. Let's see what that means.
James, I'm a peace extremist, you know? I want I want people to start taking responsibility for the behavior of their nation. I want my representatives to get a spine and stand up and start leading. I want accountability for all the terrible mistakes that have occurred that have put us in this dreadful situation. I proudly wear the banner of a badge of being a person for peace. And, you know, people can criticize. It's okay. They need to do that. They get paid to do that. So be it. You know, part of what I hoped to do when we began this journey of speaking the truth was to get national dialogue going. And part of the national dialogue will be the people who disagree and criticize and find faults and try to shame us. But I would say to any of those folks, you know, especially the commentators, you know, kind of the rabid commentators, talk to me after you have a loved one serving. Then we can have a different conversation.
Okay, so when the potter talks about, I want people to start taking responsibility for the behavior of their nation. Within the context of what? Because if that basically means voting out one administrator for the ruling class, the Republicans, as opposed to the Democrats, who, as I just discussed, there wasn't this type of outcry by the peace movement, quote unquote, during Crime Bill Clinton's administration, even though the Iraqi people were under the barbaric grip of the imperial forces. People were being sick, being made sick by the depleted uranium and other things that Sam had unleashed earlier during the first Gulf War. And Sam had done everything to undermine, under the Democratic Party, to undermine the Iraqi people and the doctors getting the right medical treatment, attention, and equipment, all under the guise of controlling and containing Saddam from getting his hands on equipment and material that he could use for weapons of mass destruction. In other words, this is all a farce. When she talks about we want accountability for their mistakes, first of all, see, this is just a game. This is a play on words. This is not a mistake by the rulers. See, this is how people gumpify themselves down into an illusion or are just playing a game, a ruthless game. These guys are not making a mistake. They may be making a tactical mistake, but they're not making a political mistake from the standpoint of how imperialism works in controlling and trying to control other people's resources, making expendable people from other countries, making expendable people from this country who are part of the disposable class. That's not a mistake. Now, to make them accountable is to have the type of class reality that understands that this is all part and parcel of being in a capitalist system. The reality is this type of stuff has always gone on. The mistake that the rulers see themselves in now is the type of mistake that says, okay, we didn't go in with enough forces, probably because we didn't want to start the draft and what that may entail, the resistance that may entail, et cetera, et cetera. Now we have ourselves in a particular quagmire. But this particular occupation is really not much different than the type of occupation that Sam did in Panama, except that the smaller Panama was much easier brought to his knees and docilized, so to speak. If Iraq had been subdued in the same manner that Panama was, there would be no real debate amongst these Democrats. There would be no real debate amongst these Republicans, some of whom are now, you know, breaking off and talking about retreat, et cetera, et cetera, or within the elite circles. In other words, the various elite circles that you see some consternation now growing and talk of withdrawing the forces, that exists within the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and the elite party. It has nothing to do with a moral base or a class sympathy base against the masses of people who are being demolished under this barbaric imperial endeavor. It has to do with the fact that the imperial onslaught is not working as effectively as they would have liked. So there's discussion about reining it in and trying other particular types of strategies, et cetera, et cetera. Now, under the Panama invasion, though, which was just as criminal, Sam broke international laws. Sam was condemned internationally in the world court for this illegal invasion. So the criminality was just as flagrant as the invasion into Iraq. But it more or less went smoothly. They captured Manuel Noriega. The population was somewhat subdued and terrified. They put in their proper government. There wasn't a large resistance movement that grew out of it, and i.e., U.S. G.I. Joes didn't get their ass shot off in large numbers to create the quote-unquote quagmire scenario. So, there wasn't no accountability for any of these rulers, Republican, Democrat, administrators, who helped facilitate this war in Panama and benefited from this war. So once again, the whole concept of what the peace movement in America is standing for, quite often, is not on the grounds of being against imperial outreach and destruction on a national and international level. It has to do with the fact of some of these things can go awry and cause a Vietnam-type syndrome. So we see this whole thing take place over and over again. When she talks about, I want my representatives to get a spine and stand up and start being leaders, what the heck? Look, they have a spine. Their spine is injected with the poison of their ruling class elite masters. That's what straightens them up and has them operating in their dronish, hawkish ways. Look, before the first Gulf War, what the barrel of gas, you know, the one in the 90s, a barrel of gas was around, what, $13, $14 a barrel. And when the war started, the first Gulf War, it went up over $30 a barrel. Now, there was no real justifiable reason. It was just the imperialists could use this to do that. They used their imperial war to justify raising the prices on an international level. Now, this current war, we find a barrel of oil now has jumped up to about $60 a barrel. Now, if someone had said before this war had started, when it was, you know, what, about $20 less than it was is now, that we should raise a barrel of gas $2 a barrel extra so that we can cover health insurance for the masses of people. Those very same legislators and representatives that the pot is talking about should have a spine, would have been the first ones to jump up and talk about taxation and so on and so forth, and this is outlandish. If we had said raise a barrel of gas a couple of dollars so that all these schools in these urban and rural areas that are in vast decay can be vastly upgraded, you would have had an onslaught of commentators talking about how outlandish it is and reckless, and the petty little liberals would have just quivered under the onslaught at very best, saying it was unreasonable and this is not a proper form of taxation, et cetera, et cetera. And they would not have seen that as being politically expedient for them to get their candidates to run under. That's because that's the way the things are structured. Because, in other words, they don't serve the masses of people. They serve their masters. But here you have these barrels of gas go skyrocketing. $10 higher, $20, $25 a barrel higher than what they once were. And there's no justifiable reason except that the elite can manipulate it under this whole war on terror drama. And at the same time, they're able to hide under the smoke of the perpetual confusion that the corporate media system and all of that apparatus puts out, knowing that no fraction that serves them, the Democrats or Republican, is going to stand up with a spine to try to organize any type of real resistance against what's happening, because they're just following their particular orders. So to have some kind of illusion that these representatives are your representatives, or as the potter said, my representatives need to get up and get a spine and stand up and start leading, is part of the fallacy of many of these people who are part of this quote-unquote peace movement. And it shows you how cynical and ahistorical things are, as John Perkins, a former economic hitman for U.S. capitalist imperial endeavors and author of the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, describes Sam's historical role of imperial war in Iraq and beyond.
Not too long after that, about 10 years later, there was a very, very popular president of Iraq whose name was Qasim. And he did the same thing. Apparently, he hadn't learned his lesson from Mossadegh. He decided that the foreign oil companies, primarily British and American, would have to pay the Iraqi people more money for the oil that they were taking out. And so he decided to implement policies similar to what the Shah of Iran had tried to implement previously to that. The CIA went in and hired an assassin, a high school senior, to take out Qasim. And the high school senior was up in the second story of a building and took a good shot at Qasim and missed him, got him in the shoulder. That high school senior was Saddam Hussein. Not a very good shot in those days. After that, the CIA executed a coup, which took it, and they captured Qasim, and they had him publicly executed on Iraqi television. Most of us aren't aware of that. But then they instilled in power Saddam Hussein's cousin, and Saddam became head of security for the country of Iran and eventually its president. What we learned in that process from both of those cases, in Iran and Iraq, was that there was a much better way to build empire than the old traditional way. That we could do it quietly, in a way that most Americans wouldn't even have any idea it was done. I mean, how many people here know the story of what I just told you about Iraq? How many have heard that story before? You're an enlightened group. I think there's six of you that have heard that before. That's a lot in a group this size. Most Americans have no idea that went on. Most Americans have no idea what went on with Mossadegh. It's been very quiet. And we realized that this was an extremely efficient way to build empire. Didn't cost much, didn't risk war. The only problem was that the CIA was directly involved in both cases. Kermit Roosevelt was a card-carrying CIA agent. Had he been discovered, or had those agents in Iraq been discovered, the American government, the U.S. government, excuse me, I don't like to use this word American, because after all, the Hondurans are Americans, and the Salvadorans and the Bolivians are all Americans, and but United Statesians is a little tough. So, we people in the United States had discovered a new way to build empire. A cheap way, a safe way to do it, but we didn't want our government implemented. So at that time in the early 60s, after what happened in Iraq, the decision was made to use organizations like the CIA and the NSA to recruit and perhaps train economic hitmen and jackals, the assassins, but that they would not work for the government. So I came along in 1968, I was a senior in Boston University, and I was recruited by the National Security Agency because it happened because of personal contacts I had. And the National Security Agency, the NSA, which sometimes is known as the No Such Agency because it's so secretive, ran me through a series of tests, polygraph tests, lie detector tests, personality tests. And they discovered several things. One was that I potentially would make a good economic hitman. And two, I had some personality flaws, which appealed to them. And I described them in detail in the book, but I can summarize them here as probably the three great drugs of our culture. Money, power, and sex. Who among us doesn't have one of those flaws? At least one of them, you know. So, after that, the NSA encouraged me to go in the Peace Corps. I was sent to Ecuador, where I worked with indigenous people in the Amazon and the Andes, people who were opposing the oil companies and still are, so I got some very good on-the-job training. And then when I came out, I was hired by the international consulting firm of Charles T. Main in Boston, and was contacted by an amazing woman named Claudine, who knew all about me, had access to my NSA files, and became my teacher and mentor. And from the very start, Claudine told me that I was getting into a dirty business. She explained to me what it would be like to be an economic hitman, and she explained it like this. She said, you know, economic hitmen, our job is to build empire, and there's a lot of different tools we use, but probably the most typical way that we approach this is to identify a third world country that has resources we covet, like oil, and then to arrange a large loan from an organization like the World Bank to that country. The money never leaves the United States, most of it. It just gets transferred from one bank to another, and it goes to pay U.S. corporations like Halliburton, Bechtel, GE, Lockheed Martin, you know the names, to build big infrastructure projects in this third world country, like power plants and industrial parks, that will serve the very rich of that country and won't affect the poor positively in any way. But the country then will be left holding a huge debt, so large a debt that it can't possibly repay it. So at some point in time, the economic hitmen will go back into this country and say, look, you owe us a lot of money, you can't repay your debts, so give us a pound of flesh, sell our oil companies, your oil real cheap, vote with us at the next United Nations vote, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world, like Iraq. And she said to me, that's the way you will go about building an empire. She gave me every reason for why I might want to do this. She knew my weaknesses and played upon them very well. She also told me, what you're doing is not illegal. In fact, it's supported by all the major business schools in the country, which was true. And Robert McNamara, the president of the World Bank, is very much behind this. In fact, McNamara often patted me on the back of what I was doing, and I ended up teaching and lecturing about this at Harvard and other schools across the country. So what I was doing was not illegal. In fact, it was very much praised. It should be illegal. And in fact, if I were your banker and I went to you and enticed you to accept a loan, knowing full well that you couldn't repay that loan because I wanted to get a favor from you later on, I'd be committing a criminal act. But if I do this on an international basis, I'm not committing a criminal act. And we write, the corporatocracy writes the international banking and commercial laws and the trade laws. That's why it's not illegal. So this was really my introduction and my training, and then I went on to do a lot of work in this area.
This helped expose the farce, once again, to this whole peace movement type of thing within the confines of how it's structured. You know, here you have a situation where, as Perkins first outlined, Saddam Hussein was hired by the CIA. He was hired to assassinate Qasem, the then president of Iraq, because they didn't like his policies. His policies weren't illegal, it was just not completely beneficial economically. He wasn't subservient enough to the U.S. Empire process of economic imperial empire building. So he has to be disposed of. This was an act of war. And this policy and the role that John Perkins and others have played has been basically a continuous war on humanity. So to get caught up in one administration as opposed to another is a farce. You can't be a peace activist and support this system of imperial capital machinery that is part of a perpetual war apparatus, because it goes part and parcel. This machine of capital imperialism is a machine of war. That's how it has to operate. That's how it will operate until the machine is destroyed. Now, so here Qasem gets executed publicly on TV. So here you have a war against the wishes of the people of Iraq, who had democratically elected this particular person, in the same way that Sam is right now undermining the will and wishes of the people of Haiti. In other words, he intentionally retards any type of forms of democratic process. With all the problems that a Qasem would have or an Aristide, it's still Sam in there in the mix with his overall imperial intervention. And what type and what forms of mechanisms, what institutions that he does he put in place? Well, Saddam Hussein types. Barbarians in his image. So as Perkins goes on, he talked about how basically this form of economic hitmanism with the CIAs, the NSAs, the jackals, you know, the assassins, all of that, the empire found that this is a way to quietly and cheaply and safely build empire. But what they're still talking about doing is waging war. Now, once again, many of these peace activist types, their condemnation of a particular administration who goes outside of those parameters, basically out of their own political necessity, and because of how they see the grand chessboard at this particular time on what they need to do. In other words, they couldn't penetrate in and get Saddam assassinated in a way that they would have preferred, and quietly get someone in his place that could have basically been just like him with a new face, but still hold the policies that they want, turn the euro dollar that Saddam had flipped from the U.S. to the euro back to, you know, to the U.S. dollar and things like that. That particular thing wasn't going to work out in the way things were set up. So they just got raw dog. And then this went with the boots on the ground. But the boots on the ground and the economic hush puppies on the ground are still the boots of the beast. They're still the shoes, the hooves of the beast. Because they still operate with the motive of mind of empire building for the U.S. capital machine. Now, as Perkins pointed out, as he found out as an economic hitman, his job was to help build empires, find third world countries that had lots of, you know, natural resources, give them various fake-type loans through the World Bank, where they would build large infrastructure projects, you know, like in India with all these unnecessary dams that are very destructive, Kenya, the same thing, et cetera, et cetera. They don't positively affect the poor people as a matter of fact, they often destroy many of the poor people's natural habitat and dislocate them from their land. Or if it's like the Mobile and Chevron, they're poisoning the countryside of Nigeria. So this is part of the imperial apparatus. And then once these countries have these huge debts and can't pay, then they have these countries under their grip, where they can coerce them to vote the way they want, send in the troops, have these guys send in their troops to Sam's imperial endeavors and so on and so forth. And none of this stuff is illegal. This is how this imperial apparatus works. If one looks at the situation honestly and what happened with Rwanda, one can see the hooves of the imperial outreach of the economic hitman, the corporations and how it manifests, the World Bank, IMF institutions. Here you had a situation where the country got deeply in debt. Kind of like how John Perkins described. It happened in Rwanda. And then you had a situation where the particular, like, puppet and minuscule, silly regimes that are in power find themselves in a situation where they can't really go to the populace and say, look, we followed these guys' program, we followed their efforts, we laid down for them the type of imperial infrastructure building that they want, and this is the result, the collapse of our infrastructure. Of course they're not going to say that. They're going to do what all these little regimes that get put within the spear of the powerful imperialists do. They're going to try to play off ethnic divisions and so on and so forth. So you have the, oh, it's the Tutsis' fault. And this thing helped climax into the catastrophe that you saw in Rwanda. But its core grip of destabilization happened within the realm of the imperial World Bank IMF grip of the Western powers, Sam, France, etc., etc. In other words, the genocide was part and parcel tied into the war that the imperial structure has. on the third world and the rest of the rest of the planet as they play themselves out and play out their war game. But here is an Iraqi war vet, Alex Riddall, describing what his first sergeant said to him and the troops about Sam's reasoning for going to war in Iraq, to help expose that there's no excuse and there is no one who puts on the boots for the imperial machine of Sam. There's no one that's innocent.
The thing is, before going to Iraq, the reasons were questionable. We even had our first sergeant come out and tell us, you know, this man's a veteran of the first Persian Gulf War, been in the Marine Corps 20 plus years, and he actually, after our commanding officer told us that, yes, we're going to Iraq, he came out to talk to us and said, in going to Iraq, don't think you're going to be heroes. Don't think you're going there to topple Saddam, find weapons of mass destruction, or make Iraq safe for democracy. He said you're going there for one reason alone, and that's oil. And this is our first sergeant. This was Camp Lejeune. This was on base. And, you know, a lot of the younger guys were taken back by this because these were, you know, it's not the official reason for going to Iraq. This is not what's being plastered all over the media. But, you know, guys like myself who had been in for a while, just we knew the government was involved in underhanded things, and it seemed this time that we would be involved in one.
So once again, things have gotten so raw that basically a lot of things that are going on is kind of when Sam was first constructing the nation. They really couldn't have time playing the role too much about their overall desires. With much of the indigenous aboriginal population, they just had to be exterminated. It was just that raw. And when one honestly looks at what happened northeast, southwest of America, you saw a ruthless extermination program. People forced into concentration, i.e. reservation camps, and being expected to die off, lose one's identity, be destroy of their natural cultural awareness of oneself. It's a form of genocide. The imperial empire of America finds itself in a form of competition with other market systems, and it's expanding its outreach and turning the whole world into a giant Indian reservation. And just as ruthless as it was towards the aboriginal population, often without any pretense of civility, is playing this role out today. And this veteran just had a dose of this. Now, within this same framework, though, of the state empire legitimacy, here's a right-wing hocus-pocus icon, Pat Robinson, on the 700 Club, talking about assassinating Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela. You know, because for all of them, at the end of the day, it's all about peace and stability for empire.
You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war.
So here you heard Pat Robinson just straight out. Now, what did that sound like, though? It was basically similar to what Perkins was saying through his economic hitman experience. Part of the reason that the economic hitman strategy became so popular was because it took on a quiet form of empire building, and it was on the cheap. You know, you didn't have to use your troops. Now, they'll use troops when necessary, i.e. Panama, you know, et cetera, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan. But if they don't have to maintain the peace and stability for U.S. empire, which, of course, is just a play on words because it's all about war, perpetual war, then one can't hesitate to use various assassination terroristic tactics. As Perkins was saying, on the quiet, cheap, and safe. That's essentially what Robinson was saying. So this shows how cynical this whole process is. Because if, say, Hugo Chavez was assassinated and they were able to get some kind of a reactionary force with dictatorial policies in and crush many of the population without Sam having to have to put his boots in, just by the disturbances that the Jackals, the CIA, the NSA, the economic hitmen were able to create. Many of these peace activists really wouldn't have much to say about it. And they wouldn't have the type of platform that many of them are artificially being given today, because there wouldn't be a crisis within the structural mechanisms that allows the debate to come up. So all of these people are operating, these peace activists and others, including Pat Robinson, within the parameters that the empire finds acceptable. This is imperial peace talk. That's what all of them are doing. So from me talking about the whole aspect of how the gasoline prices went up and how that is not something that could be on the table, because in essence what we're talking about is a form of taxation through imperial occupation, that's acceptable within all of this framework. And Pat Robinson's statement overall, even though they don't like it outwardly said like that, now we know that these actions take place. There's a large history and legacy of these types of tactics, as Perkins was outlining, and as Pat Robinson knows himself. But here, once again, is Perkins with talking about, in essence, specifically what Pat Robinson was talking about, the quietness and cheapness of dealing with Chavez. Now, Perkins isn't talking about Chavez in particular. He's talking about how the economic hitman is a favorable strategy for the empire.
It's been very quiet, and we realized that this was an extremely efficient way to build empire. Didn't cost much, didn't risk war. The only problem was that the CIA was directly involved in both cases. Kermit Roosevelt was a card-carrying CIA agent. Had he been discovered, or had those agents in Iraq been discovered, the U.S. government, I don't like to use this word American, because after all, the Hondurans are Americans, and the Salvadorans and the Bolivians are all Americans. But the United Statesians is a little tough. So we people in the United States had discovered a new way to build empire, a cheap way, a safe way to do it, but we didn't want our government implemented. So at that time in the early 60s, after what happened in Iraq, the decision was made to use organizations like the CIA and the NSA to recruit and perhaps train economic hitmen and jackals, the assassins, but that they would not work for the government.
But they were working for the corporate machinery, which is part of the U.S. imperial machinery, which is basically a war on the world population. So unless you deal with that infrastructure as it exists, which goes outside of the parameters of supporting a Democratic or a Republican, your version of peace activism is a form of peace imperialism, an acceptable form. Now, they may, you know, rant and rave and denounce you on the corporate networks and all of that, but that's all style and, you know, strategy and, you know, imagery and so on and so forth. That's creating artificial debates to look like there's a real debate on a particular issue, while they at the same time control the parameters of the particular debate. So when people start now yapping about Pat Robinson's statement, maybe he went over the line, and you see the liberals jumping on it and want him to retract it and all of that, this is all smoke and mirrors. One must keep one's eyes on the prize, because as we all know, Sam does have an assassination policy. So the fact that Robinson outwardly saying it and retracting his statement, or if he were to retract it, of course, this is not what he's done. He's tried to say that people misinterpreted him. But even if he were to retract it, it's all smoke and mirrors game. In the same way that they're portraying this whole peace movement going on as something other than what it is, when you're a peace activist supporting the imperial troops, then you're part of the imperial peace movement. Now, remember, many of these administrators for the ruling class and talking head pundits were talking all types of chill 'em up statements in the past. They were talking about killing Saddam. They were talking about killing Gaddafi in the past. They were talking about how they were tired of Noriega and kicking sand and use words like we're going to kick Saddam's ass, which basically meant, you know, wreck and pillage the population. They outwardly many times tried to kill and dispose of Fidel Castro. And the real original, I should say, September 11th in Chile, the 1973 coup that the CIA helped orchestrate, that directly led to the death of Allende. So this is part and parcel of the empire's policy. Robinson was just saying it on his little silly show. But all of these people say it as a form of peace and stability for the nation. Now, the only thing that seems to get some of these liberal peace activist feathers riled up in the Democratic Party and so on and so forth is when these peace endeavors go somewhat awry, and they have to either put boots on the ground of the particular country, and an unacceptable number of people from this land lose their lives. That's this imperial peacemongering. Now, as I was saying, of course, old Pat is lying about what he said. You already heard him. And classic hypocrisy, he is now saying that it was misinterpreted. This is how they always spin things. People misinterpret it. People are exaggerating what they said. Check them out. It's called peace.
And I didn't say assassination. I said our special forces should go take him out. And take him out can be a number of things, including kidnapping. There are a number of ways to take out a dictator from power besides killing him. Now, I was misinterpreted by the AP, but that happens all the time.
Now, this wasn't on the AP. This was on his broadcast show. What's he talking about? It was direct. He has his little Christian broadcast show with all his little drones watching. That's where it was recorded off of. But once again, these are his own words.
You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war.
So they just lie. They just make up stuff. And then him trying to smooth it out with kidnapping, you know, Noriega style. You know, one minute Noriega's on the payroll, next minute they kidnap him. You know, one minute Saddam Hussein is given the rifle to play Mr. Assassin, becomes president, all good. Next minute, you know, the Frankenstein monster goes awry. Dr. Frankenstein, you know, burns down the fortress. This is all part of the imperial policy until Dr. Frankenstein, Sam, is killed. Then you can't call yourself, or until you actively work to kill Sam and not align yourself with any of his Igors, you know, Democratic Igors or Republican Igors, then you're just an imperial peacemonger. Now to wrap this up. Another thing that's being called in the name of peace, you know, from the whole Cindy Sheehan movement, you know, that form of peace, to Pat Robinson's form of imperial peace, through this form, where the forced removal of these little sick Zionist settlers in the West Bank of Gaza, this is being portrayed by the world imperialists as a concession for peace. You know, they call it the Sharon Disengagement Plan. Here's Morton Klein, he's president of this Zionist Organization of America. And he's also hooked up with AIPAC. He talks about the pullout from his Zionist perspective.
Well, besides this being a human rights disaster, I mean, suppose Ariel Sharon were to remove there are 10,000 Arabs who live in Tel Aviv among a million Jews. If he had decided to remove those 10,000 Arabs, I think the world would be responding quite severely against this. But remarkably, of course, the 10,000 Arabs there don't need protection. They don't have to worry about their lives being harmed, as the Jews, of course, are always under threat by living near Arabs. But my biggest worry about this is that this clearly rewards terrorism. And as an American, and who's a supporter of the international war against radical Islamic terrorism, I am afraid that if you're rewarding terrorism in Gaza and Israel, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorists see that if terrorism works there, it will only encourage more terrorism against us, against the West, against Europe. So this is my biggest fear, why I'm against this policy.
So there it is again. It's a classic strategy. The imperialists, the pro-imperialists, play victim. You know, you heard Pat Robinson talking about, you know, taking out Chavez, and it was based off of Chavez links to actions and policies of radical network, and undermining more or less the stability of Sam, of empire. So, you know, Sam may, you know, need to just take him out, go ahead and do it. Now you have this little Zionist yapping, talking about it's the Jews under the threat, and that this is rewarding terrorism. while they're the terrorists. So, once again, it's all tied in to the acceptable form of peaceful imperialism. This is the politics of peace, how it's played within the network of the imperialists. Play victim or don't critically examine honestly the role of the imperialists and do plays on words like bring our boys and girls home, withdraw them as if that really means that the imperialists are withdrawn when you know all those bases are going to be there. There's no real talk about trying these bandits for their crime against humanity. Boy George, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, colon cancer Powell, and all of that, because this is all imperial politics that they're talking. They know that they're using double speed. They know that bringing the troops home doesn't really mean bringing the troops home because those bases are going to be there. They know that Sam has intentions on controlling a vital energy source of the world economy, and that Iraq is one of the keys to that. So this is not about electoral politics. This is about imperial politics, because those who are involved in electoral politics are part of the imperial structure. But if you try to play it like that, then you're playing imperial your imperial peace game. This is all about imperialists in the age of the politics of peace. Double talk. Now, Klein goes on and describes why Sharon says he's pulling the settlers out. Check it out.
I asked him this question when I met with him at the Blair House, across the street from the White House, in early May. He told me what a tragedy this is, and he said he's had enormous pressure from Europe and the United States to make some sort of major move, or else there were all sorts of threats of various consequences. That is what he said to me, with 30 others in the room, as to why he's doing this. Because to this unilateral withdrawal, to get nothing in return, only sends a message that terrorism pays. This is a historic mistake. Giving it over to Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, who has already invited Al-Qaeda to come into Gaza, Hamas to set up headquarters there, and other terror groups from Syria are all announced they're going to set up terror groups there to establish a terror state.
This is all rhetoric. Al-Qaeda, but did they get the approval of Sam first? I mean, this is just rhetoric. But see, this is how the imperial peace rhetoric goes. So, I mean, does no one in their right mind believes that Israel is through with this particular situation, that they're going to pull, quote-unquote, their little settlers out, and that the Palestinians will be allowed to live in peace? These are just strategic moves on their little chessboard that they're playing. They still have overall intentions of control and domination of the Palestinians and the region, because that's how imperialists work. So various strategies and pullbacks and all of that does not change their overall goal any more than it does any of the other micro imperial setups. And to show you how much of a sham that these types of people get themselves locked into, from this concept, the greatest extermination that's taking place of Muslims on the planet right now is not in Iraq, not in Palestine, Israel. It's in the Sudan. But the reality is that many of the people who are of Arab Muslim descent who condemn what's going on in Iraq justifiably, and who condemn what's going on in Palestine justifiably, are complete hypocrites when this extermination of their so-called Muslim brothers and sisters are taking place in the Darfur region. Now, at the same time, the Arab Islamic government is portraying itself as a government that's trying to foment peace. It signed this peace deal with the South and all of this type of stuff. Now, in the same way that this is a charade and just a tactic, because they still have their overall goal of Arabicization, neutralization, expansion of their vision of Arabic identity, of their microeconomic capitalist forms of system under the Sharia law, et cetera, et cetera. This was just a strategic maneuver so that they can more or less rebuild their forces, get some of the pressure off internationally, get some of their oil stuff flowing at a more efficient level, etc., etc. Because at the same time that they were supposedly involved in this peace deal with the South, they have the war going on in, against the Darfurians, the black folks in the western part, and they have concentration camps, literally, of extermination against the Nuba people. So here you have some of the original people on the planet, Nubas, being exterminated by these Islamic Zionists, Christopher Columbus's with turbans on. And the way that many of these bandits, these creatures, these lowlives in the NIF, National Islamic Front, the Khartoum government, are able to get away with it is by playing the Arabic slash Islamic card. And many of their people fall in line and portray everyone outside of them as being the terrorists, as being the warmongers, the Darfurians, the black people of the South, the Nubas, etc., etc., the Furs, the Dinkas, everyone else. In the same way that the Hebrew Zionists are able to play their little religious ethnic identity card and demonize the Arabs, the Palestinians in their region. Now, they all use this because they know that they can hypnotize and pacify much of their population and many of their critics into submission as they expand their overall goal of imperial expansion. This is some of the sickest stuff that's taking place. And they all claim they're doing it in the name of peace. From the barbarians in the Khartoum government with their Arabic Islamic vision of the region, if not world. From the Zionists in Palestine, Israel, Sharon and company. To, of course, Dr. Frankenstein, Sam himself, and all of those who align themselves. If you are, you know, like an Islam Arab, and you denounce what's going on in Palestine justifiably, and justifiably denounce the barbarity that Sam is unleashing against the Iraqi people, but look the other way or justify what's going on in the Sudan, you're just as much as of a hypocrite as these peace imperialists who fake it on the issue of the overall policies of Sam's imperialism. You're part of the problem. You're complicit with peace imperialism on the planet today. Hold on a sec. wrap this up on Slave tonight. Last week, the show dealt with the concept of extremism and how that is in the eye of the beholder. From Frederick Douglass, who was considered an extremist for trying to free himself and other sisters and brothers from the shackles of Sam's barbaric slave system. Frederick and Harriet Tubman found themselves being wanted by the state for execution for taking means to end slavery. To Robert F. Williams, who organized Sisters and Brothers in North Carolina and created a phenomenon known as Negroes with Guns that fought off the Klan, and of course that was considered a form of extremism. To as we went through Malcolm X's debate in Oxford and how Malcolm was painted as an extremist, to actually how many folks consider slave revolt too extreme. The tradition continues. But this past week, Nora O'Donnell from MSNBC said to Colin Polly, or Raleigh, who is a former FBI whistleblower, and now she's running to Congress, this is what she had to say concerning extremism about people who consider themselves anti-war.
Democrat running for Congress. It was reported that Republican leaders in your state were just thrilled that you had decided to align yourself with anti-war extremists. Do you think that this could affect your race for Congress? Well, I will quickly correct the record that they are not anti-war extremists. The majority of the people I saw down in Crawford were actually veterans groups. There were military families. And
but, Colleen, they do oppose the war in Iraq, do they not?
Yes, they do, but that does not make them, I guess the term extremist. They're really, I think, reflective of mainstream America in many ways.
So the term extremism still plays itself out. Now, once again, this is within the context of how the corporate machinery and the others who support these institutions portrays the game. Just opposing the war, you're considered extreme. And if you are conditioned or allow yourself to be conditioned within that framework, then going outside of those parameters and challenging soldiers or anyone else who plays a part in this imperial catastrophe, then you're beyond extreme. So the enemy, once again, will always try to set what is an extreme and what is not to bring people under fold, because they know that the extreme game of control of human life, soul, resources, and the health of this planet is taking the true concept of extremism well beyond most people's imagination. Hold on a second. Just going to about wrap it up for Slave tonight. It's clear that we cannot allow ourselves to get caught up into a form of peaceful imperialism. because that extreme form of hypocrisy would not take us to any higher ground, but at the end of the day, just have us resting under the ground. Until the next time, slave out.